Welcome to the Caving Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Pelzer, chairman of the Central Indiana Grotto of the National Speleological Society. And as I'm sure you've already noticed, Happy New Year. We're kicking off 2018 with the president of the National Speleological Society, or NSS, Gary Schindel. More on that in just a few minutes. If you're just discovering this podcast, welcome. If you're curious about caving and you want to know, say, how to find caves or how to get into them, what you need to know first is that caving can be dangerous if you don't know what you're doing. So joining your local grotto, that's a chapter, local chapter of the NSS, is the best way to get all that information. Before cavers will share that information with you, they like to make sure that you're doing it safely and for the right reasons. You know, we deal with trespassing and vandalisms and accidents and the like all the time. And so we try very hard to keep this information private and safe until you're ready for it. I got to do some caving in December, just a grotto trip into Indiana's Upper Twin and Bronson Donaldson, all caves in Spring Mill State Park in Mitchell, Indiana, home of astronaut Gus Grissom. There's even a Gus Grissom memorial, of course, on the park grounds. Admittedly, I changed into my wetsuit in the parking lot of the museum. Attendance that day was sparse, thank goodness. We got a special permit to go caving on state property. That's not really something you can get in almost any other circumstance other than this particular trip in Indiana. So we parked a few cars in the park, and then we took the rest to the Indiana Karst Conservancy property across the road, where there's another entrance to Upper Twin. So we did a through trip into the park. Then we hiked over the ridge to enter Bronson Cave and came out Donaldson. A very wet trip. We were swimming through a good bit of it, and we had a big group. And we knew when we were under the highway, too. We could hear the cars overhead. I love that. Twin Cave has a boat tour for the public during the summertime. It's a great tour put on by Spring Mill State Park. There's a dam that keeps the water level up for part of the year so the boats can go through. But this was a great trip. Our grotto has put this one on for a few years now, and I'm glad that I finally got to do it. Well, the holidays are over, and if you didn't get what you wanted and you want to treat yourself, hit up one of our sponsors, Organic Robot on Etsy. High-quality shirts with great designs showing off your favorite outdoor activities, be it hiking, climbing, camping, or, of course, caving. There's probably more caving shirts than anything else on there. Pick up a caving dad, caving mom, caving kid shirt, or the nice rack shirt, or the camping hair don't care shirt. Brilliant award-winning designs. Many of them are available on moisture-wicking fabrics. Show the world you're a caver. Visit the Etsy store. Just Google Organic Robot, all one word, Organic Robot. Click the Etsy link. Before we get to Gary, a quick reminder, the Caving Podcast is on Patreon. This is a way for you to directly support the podcast, and anything donated on Patreon will be put right back into caving. It'll go toward my Indiana Karst Conservancy membership. I'm hoping to get memberships to other conservancies in the coming year. This podcast is a lot of work, and if everyone listening just pledged a dollar, not a dollar a month, but just a single dollar, I'd have over $1,000, all of which would go right back into caving in the donations to conservancies, grottos, the NSS. I know I won't get that much, but if I could get a single-digit fraction of that, that would really be something. If you want to be a part of that fraction, just visit patreon.com/cavingpodcast, patreon.com/cavingpodcast, and thank you. Okay, I'm so glad to kick off 2018. So glad that Gary was willing to do this, and as you'll hear, he was eager to share a lot. Great stories from his earlier days exploring Roppel, his professional connection to caving. We get into caving leadership later in the conversation. I had such a great time with him. This was over Skype, and it turned out really great. It opens up the possibility of bringing more national guests in this year, which I'm really hoping to do. I am happy to bring you NSS President Gary Schindel. Gary, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the podcast.
Well, thank you, Matt, for having me.
I guess let's just start at the beginning. When and where did you start caving?
Well, that's a good question. I read a book on caves called The Story of Caves that intrigued me when I was 11 or 12. And then we went to visit my uncle, who lived in Radcliffe, Kentucky. And one of the things we did was we went to Mammoth Cave. And so I think Mammoth Cave has been a lot of people's first cave that they visited. And so got excited about that. And then my mother worked at a school where there were a number of teachers that had an explorer post, Boy Scout explorer post, and their specialty was caving and canoeing. And so as soon as I turned 14, I joined the Boy Scout, the explorer post, and basically learned, you know, basic horizontal caving skills and that, and then continued to do more reading and research and actually check books out of the library and tried to get in contact with some other cavers and that. But when you're 14 or 15, that's hard to do. By the time I was 16 or 17, I'd actually gotten a copy of Caverns of West Virginia because I grew up in the Maryland area, and went through that and also Caves of Maryland and started visiting some of the caves, and then basically found the NSS. And when I was 17, I joined.
17. So, I mean, it seems like you were very interested from early on and you kind of sought it out. It's not like it found you.
No, that's correct. I knew my current profession is as a geologist, and I knew I wanted to be a geologist when I was probably 10 or 11. And by 14, I realized that I had to study caves, and read the introduction to Caverns of West Virginia, the hydrology section written by William E. Davies, who was a former NSS president. And that just intrigued me, and was fortunate enough to actually meet him in his later years when he was a speaker at a D.C. grotto meeting. And one of the great pleasures of my life was introducing myself to him, and truly a gentleman, and have since seen his name in the literature, both caving and as a geological engineer. He did a lot of work outside of caves for the U.S. Geological Survey.
And so as a geologist, would you say you're more of a, I guess this is really the only way I could say this, more of a scientific caver, or are you a project caver, or really would you say you're all of the above?
Well, probably all of the above. I actually have to go caving for my job. I'm the chief technical officer at the Edwards Aquifer Authority in San Antonio, Texas. And one of my duties is to do what are called geological assessments for properties for possible inclusion into the city of San Antonio's conservation easement. It's actually called the Edwards Aquifer Protection Program. And they purchase conservation easements, or they purchase land fee simple to preserve water quality and quantity for the Edwards Aquifer. And the Edwards is a karst aquifer. It's one of the it was actually the very first sole source aquifer designated in the U.S. It is the water source for 2 million people. And it's actually very unique geologically. But I guess my last caving trip was actually visiting a number of caves on a piece of property that we're considering purchasing the conservation easement on.
I'm very curious about that. First of all, how cool to have to go caving for work. Secondly, how close do you get to the actual aquifer when you're going caving and I'm assuming taking samples and maybe setting wells and things like that?
Well, reaching the aquifer is always the goal, but it's actually fairly rare. There are a handful of caves in the hill country where you can actually visit or see the Edwards Aquifer, the actual water table in that. But the caves themselves record the flow patterns in the rock, and they give us an idea of how the Edwards Aquifer formed and how it's currently functioning. And so occasionally I get to do that. You know, we have a series of dye traces that I've performed. We have to sometimes enter caves to inject dye. I currently have a dye trace going on at the Devil Sinkhole up in Rock Springs area, Edwards County, Texas. So, you know, you have to rappel down the 150-foot deep shaft and inject dye, and we've set up a big monitoring program. And then we have some other projects. So I've actually ended up doing a fair amount of vertical work for my job, too.
Wow. So was it work then that brought you to San Antonio?
Yeah, I was before I worked for the Edwards Aquifer Authority, I was a project manager and director of karst hydrology for a company called Eckenfelder, which was later bought by Brown and Caldwell. They were based in Nashville, Tennessee, and I was hired specifically because of my karst background to come down and basically develop the science programs for the Edwards Aquifer Authority.
So it really sounds to me like you are geared for this position as NSS president. I mean, you are professionally entwined with caves in a very, very big and real way.
Well, I guess that's correct. I've been working on cave and karst issues since graduate school in the mid-80s, early 80s, and since then have been involved in karst hydrology and hydrogeology. Throughout, really, I guess the South, mostly the Southeast, but actually I've worked in about 35 states in a number of foreign countries dealing with both karst issues and groundwater issues.
So I guess going back to sort of the genesis of your caving life, when did you really get serious? You said your interest in geology was from a very early age, but when did you get serious in the caving world beyond show caves like Mammoth Cave and the like?
Well, I started caving in wild caves when I was 14, and by 17 had joined the NSS. By 18 or 19, actually, I guess I by 19, I think I was the chair of the Sligo Grotto in D.C. and took a little bit longer to get into mapping and project caving. Back in those days, it was sometimes hard to get into the project caving in some of the caves in West Virginia. I think it's maybe a little bit easier now. But actually, I guess I got very involved with driving down. When I went to school at West Virginia University, I got involved with the project down at Roppel Cave in Kentucky, and drove down there for a number of trips, and then ended up going to graduate school at Western Kentucky University in Bowling Green. And I think I was the fourth or fifth graduate student there under Nick Crawford and Ron Dillemarter. And then while I was there, I ended up working at Mammoth Cave National Park for Jim Quinlan. And so I was fortunate enough to basically be completely immersed in the karst field for about 3 or 4 years. And so I worked as a research assistant for Dr. Crawford, and helped him with his research associated with the karst hydrology of the Bowling Green area. And then I also worked for Jim Quinlan and worked with his team of cavers, Don Coons and Sherry Engler and Chris Gerace, Chris Kerr, myself, and a few other folks. And we worked for 2.5, 3 years, the final 3 years of that program with Jim Quinlan, helping map some of the caves in the Mammoth Cave area. Wigpistle in particular is the one I worked on. But the program had been going on for a number of years, and there was some very fine caving that had been done.
Would you consider that one of your first big major projects?
Well, I'd helped with some mapping in the West Virginia area on smaller trips, but, getting involved in the Roppel project and trying to get down there and cave. In the early days when Roppel was just first opening up, it was, 4 or 5 miles long, 6 miles long, something like that. And then Jim Kearns and Bill Walter basically pushed into some of the major trunk and blew the cave wide open. And at that point, it just took off. And I was very fortunate to be involved in some of the early days there. I didn't do nearly as much caving as others. And then at that point, I got more involved with caving with Jim Quinlan's group, because we were caving in the summer. We were doing 2 trips, sometimes 3 trips a week in Wigpistle, which was a 20-mile-long cave at the time. And those were long, hard, drawn-out trips, 24-hour wetsuit trips. And so they take their toll on you. But if the weather was stable, we'd be in there sometimes twice, sometimes even, depending on the schedule, 3 times in a week.
So, what I'm gathering from this is that, obviously when you're young, you can be hardcore, but you were hardcore. You were really in there and really doing it. Did you ever come close to, the common psychological issues of, claustrophobia and things like that? I mean, it doesn't sound like you're really prone to that.
Well, not then. As I'm getting older, my flexibility and strength and endurance has diminished some. I can tell that. But We were, I would like to think we were on the cutting edge doing some wonderful exploration in Wigpistle. It's an amazing cave. And then once we were done, when the cave basically program shut down, and then soon after Jim left the National Park Service, it was, you know, I don't think anybody been in the cave in years. And now it's been, you know, connected into the Martin's Ridge and Jackpot and Wigpistle have all been put together. Matter of fact, it was very interesting. I got a real interesting call from John Jasper and Alan. And Alan called me one day and said, hey, did you leave a poker chip in Wigpistle Cave? And it's like, well, yeah, we left a lot of them, you know. We would use those poker chips to mark, you know, ends of survey stations. And he goes, well, we found this poker chip numbered such and such and some footprints, and we were wondering if it was yours. They sort of described it, and I said, well, I don't remember the number, but, you know, yeah, that was our poker chip, and they connected it Martin Ridge into Wigpistle, and trust me, it was a long, long ways out in Wigpistle, requiring the 3 or 4 very, very long low sumps and a 24-hour trip to get back there and do any surveying and that. So it was a phenomenal trip. We actually ended the cave. We were mapping in a low, wide passage and about 2 or 3 feet of water in it, and we were mapping in the thing, and then T intersected the large trunk and kind of ran down it for 100 feet in both directions or so, and thought we would come back. We set a poker chip and actually left part of a hanging survey because we'd froze out. And then at that point, there were big floods in the area, and we never got back into the cave. And so that was probably the best lead in the, you know, central Kentucky area for many, many years, was the lead at the end of Wigpistle. And I was quite pleased to hear those guys connecting into it from that direction. When they found miles of cave up there.
Oh, yeah. When did that happen? When did they pick up where you left off?
I guess it was probably the late 90s. I'd have to go back and look.
Yeah.
You know, there's some very nice documentation on their trips and things in the NSS News, but I think my memory's starting to go as well as my flexibility.
Well, I don't mean to call you out and make you prognosticate or anything like that here, but but it seems like, gosh, you know, with the honeycombing down there in Kentucky, and I mean, obviously Mammoth is there and Fisher Ridge and all these big systems, what do you think is the possibility of an enormous system connecting to an even bigger system down there? I mean, does that area just need to keep being pushed? I mean, are we just going to keep finding big stuff there?
Well, they keep adding, you know, miles, you know, to the Mammoth Cave, you know, Flint Ridge system. At some point, I would suspect that Fisher Ridge, which is over 100 miles long, will get connected into, and at that point, the system will be over 500 miles. You know, it's connected hydrologically, so you know, it just requires, you know, persistence and some luck. And I think that area certainly produces cavers who have a combination of that and have for many years. It's a phenomenal story, and I'd certainly encourage you all to go back and read some of the books on the, you know, the exploration of the Mammoth Cave and Rapel Cave.
Yeah, books like, The Longest Cave and some other titles. Throw some out at me.
Caves Beyond the Longest Cave and then Beyond Mammoth are the three books. And at some point, hopefully there'll be a book about Fisher Ridge.
Oh, that'd be something. You may have already answered this, but I guess what discoveries can you look back on that you're particularly proud to have been involved with? Something that you maybe came across that was not only significant, you know, lengthwise, but just really cool formation wise and maybe geologically was very significant.
You know, probably it's kind of hard to say. A lot of it blends together. And, you know, just in the last year or so, we found some amazing caves as part of this geo-assessment program in the Edwards area here. And so we're still finding caves. I actually, through that process, I have a list of 125 caves that I haven't been to yet. I have GPS coordinates. I have photos of them. I may have been to the entrance, but I don't know what's in them, and we're slowly working through that list. So the fact that we've got access to, you know, literally 150,000 acres of land and landowners who are more than happy to have us come out and look at their properties is certainly intriguing, and I suspect we'll find some great caves there also. You know, there's some interesting caves down in Kentucky I've been involved with that we pushed. Certainly I was going to say a Sinking Creek Cave, which was actually more of an archaeological site, was a significant find. The problem is it ended up getting ravaged. There was a interesting lawsuit about it when we were first working the cave. That's in just south of Warren County, Kentucky. Very interesting. I'm not sure if you're interested in the details on that, but
certainly I am.
Kind of funny. Well, okay. Well, this cave has two entrances, and they're connected by a very sizable trunk passage. And so the light can shine in from both sides, and then the bottom of the cave is a stream. And the owners of the cave were very protective because there were people who were going in there digging. And we contacted them, and I used my, sort of association with Western Kentucky University, and that for some reason impressed them and thought I was a pretty good guy. And so they allowed us access into the cave, which nobody had had permission in a number of years. And as soon as we walked in, it was very apparently a major archaeological site. It was just a premier site for early Native Americans. And they were concerned that one of the entrances was very close to the road and they couldn't see it from their house, and they were seeing people trespass and dig in the cave. So they asked if I could do something about it, and they said the no trespassing signs were not working. So I wrote a sign that said, warning, no trespassing, this means you. Anyone caught trespassing will be shot. Survivors will be shot again. And we nailed it up, and that seemed to work.
I guess it would.
And then the owners ended up, they were struggling financially. It was not a good time for farming. And they allowed a guy to go in and what they called wash in the cave. And they went down one day to check on what he was doing. And he had put a pump in the stream and was literally hydraulically mining the site. And they just got very, very upset and called me. And I said, well, let me see what I can do. So I called up Phil DeBlasi at the University of Louisville and said, Phil, these people are mining the site. What do you recommend? And Phil said, well, there's this thing called the Coroner's Act. So I called the state police up, and they said, let's look it up. And they looked it up and said, oh, yes, there is. And I said, well, this guy is in there disturbing human remains. And so the state police called the coroner for Warren County and the coroner for Simpson County, because the cave's near the line. And we drove down there, and here was the guy down there washing. Well, part of the problem was when we pulled up with the state trooper, he didn't want to go on the property because there was a sign there that said anyone caught trespassing will get shot. And I convinced him that I had written the sign and it was okay, and that besides that, he had a gun. And so we went in, and the coroners looked around for a few minutes. There's area was littered with human remains. So they arrested the fella. And he ended up going to a hearing to decide whether they were going to press charges, or I guess whether they were going to go to court or not. And so actually, as a graduate student, I ended up getting asked to be a witness because I had seen what he was doing. And it was quite a novel experience for a student. And so I went down, and Phil DeBlasi came down with another fellow who was a lawyer. And Phil and I ended up being sequestered in the back of the room. And then they brought Phil out. And my understanding is the defense lawyer was questioning Phil. And the guy said, well, Mr. DeBlasi, you understand you're an educated man. Yes, yes. What's your background? What's your degrees, et cetera? And he says, well, how could an educated man write a sign that said, warning, no trespassing. Anyone caught trespassing will be shot. Survivors will get shot again. And, of course, Phil said, well, I didn't write that. Gary Schindel wrote that. And so after he was done testifying, they brought me out and we went through the same thing. And he said, Mr. Schindel, what's your background? Well, I'm in graduate school and I have a master's degree, working on my master's degree in geology and that. And they said, well, how could somebody who's considered an educated man write a sign like that? And I said, well, sir, we've been trying to keep people out of the cave and this seemed to work, but further research has indicated that's not the best no trespassing sign. The best no trespassing sign is trespassers will gut shot dead, and that's very effective. And at that point, the judge laughed, I laughed, everybody laughed, and then the defense attorney approached the bench and with the other with the prosecution, and they pleaded it out right there in front of me while I was sitting there listening to it all. It was kind of an interesting moment.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So remember that if you ever want to keep somebody out, you need a white sign with red paintbrush that says "Trust Pussers, P-U-S-S-E-R, will gut shot dead, D-E-D. And that will work.
Yeah.
That was kind of the start of trying to work in the cave. Later, Patty Jo Watson had a graduate student who was working in the cave, but the gentleman had done, or before that, but the gentleman had done, the individual who was mining the site had done so much damage, I think she couldn't continue her work.
Let's go back to this, the archaeological significance of that cave. I mean, how interesting did it, was it like sort of an obvious Native American burial site since there were so many human remains around? What were we dealing with there?
Well, you know, when I first showed up and got to talking to the owners, it took about an hour to kind of, you know, win their confidence. They brought out these two paper, you know, grocery bags full of bones. And they said, well, we don't know what these are, but we want you to look at them and lay them out. And it's like, well, that's a femur, that's a femur, that's a tibia, that's a fibia, that's a femur. Yeah, they're all
wow.
human.
Wow.
That's part of my skull cap, and you wow. need to get somebody down here who knows what this stuff is. And so Phil de Blasio and Ron Wilson came down, and then they brought Patty Jo Watson down here because the cave was relatively intact. I think part of the problem was that the neighbors were seeing us go in the cave, and they were concerned that we were digging in the cave, which we were not. There was some previous potholes in there, and some of them were fairly deep, and there was no sterile soil. It was just basically a gigantic midden, the entire cave, 150 feet long, probably 30 to 50 feet wide, and 10 feet thick in places down to the stream. And it was just littered with archaeological artifacts and animal remains and some human remains.
Wow.
So, an amazing site.
That's incredible. What's the status of that site today, if you don't mind?
My understanding is that it is closed. I can't even get in it. The neighbor, I understand the neighbor bought it and has gated it and has posted it and may have a "Trust Pushers will get gut shot dead" sign. I don't know. But I did talk to him many years ago, and he said, I don't know you, and you're going to have to get permission from the university to get in there. And I said, that's fine. The cave sounds like it's very well protected. And so that's kind of the status of it. Cave also has some wonderful fossil corals and things that were basically weathering out of the walls. The cave actually had four entrances, quite unique.
Well, it sounds to me then like you're okay with that status. Your concern is that it's protected because it was significant yeah. enough.
Yeah, so you know, I was disappointed that it wasn't able to be studied more before it had been ravaged. But you know, part of the problem with it is the entrances were quite large, and they were like 50 to 75 feet from a road, and so it was really hard to protect.
Yeah, I guess so. What are some of your favorite caves? What a generic question, but what are some of your favorite caves to revisit over and over again?
Well, you know, one of my favorite early caves, of course, was you know, my first three vertical caves was Elkhorn Hellhole and Elkhorn Mountain Cave in West Virginia Hellhole, and one of my personal favorites was Cass Cave, and I understand that's closed now. Matter of fact, I think all those caves have limited access. Those have been fantastic. Then, of course, I've been fortunate enough to cave in a number of different locations in Kentucky and Tennessee. There are some phenomenal caves in Tennessee and Alabama and Georgia, and it's kind of hard to select a favorite out of those. Of course, you know, there's the old stalwarts like Neversink and Valhalla, you know, which I did when I was probably in my early 20s, and that Cass Cave I did when I was, I don't know, 17 or 18. And then there were, you know, a number of other caves. Of course, you know, there's just some wonderful caves. One of the things I did miss when I was living in Nashville was the discovery and exploration of Blue Springs that was going on while I was in Nashville. But I was so tied up with work, and our kids were very young, that I was really not able to participate in that. I you know, it was a phenomenal find and still an amazing cave. Been able to get in there a couple times, but, you know, I know there are people who have done some amazing work there.
Let's look at some of your more memorable trips, for better or for worse, either discovery or mishaps or things like that. Do you have any of those stories in your quiver?
Well, let's see. You know, when I did some very fine caving when I worked for Jim Quinlan. One of the trips was Jim was drilling some wells and also an entrance. He was drilling the Doyle Valley entrance. And there are two interesting trips associated with that. The first one was when he was drilling the Doyle Valley entrance. He started drilling, and you drill a small hole, and then you drill a bigger hole. So you drill a pilot hole, and it intersected the cave. It was about 55 feet deep or something like that. And then the driller came in with a 17.5-inch bit, drilled that in, and then came in with a 26-inch bit. And when he was drilling it out, he broke all the drill bits. They fell down the hole because Jim had bought a used, very large, but used drill bit. And it was basically worn out, and it broke the drilling cones off, and they fell down the hole. And so Jim wanted us to retrieve them, and it was probably, I think it was October or something like that. And most of the crew, you know, that we'd worked with over the summer were gone. Don and Sherry were back in Illinois, you know, dealing with their farm issues. And then I think Christine had gone back to school. So there was just Chris Kerr and I. So we got permission to enter through, I think it was the Morrison's entrance. We rappelled down. That was had been tied into the system a couple years before, and did a couple hours worth of caving to get back to where the Doyle Valley entrance is now. And we got to the bottom of the entrance, and Jim was up top, and he lowered down a bag, and we put the broken parts of the drill bit in the bag, and he pulled it up, and then Jim lowered down a two Pizza Hut personal pan pizzas and two Cook's Premium Gold Bloom beers, which was really nice.
Yeah.
And so Chris and I had lunch, and we sat there. And then Chris said, you know, I think we should go out another entrance. And I said, well, let's see. The ropes aren't rigged in the Proctor entrance. And the other entrance that was recently, I think it's Emerson entrance, Ferguson entrance, I'm sorry, had a 50-foot climb that you had to get out of. It was unprotected and pretty dangerous and usually roped. The Ferguson entrance didn't have a rope in it. And so Chris said, "But well, why don't we go out the Roppo entrance?" And I said, well, that's a long ways. But we had our vertical gear with us, so we didn't have to backtrack to pick it up. And Chris had been in that area of the cave where the connection between Mammoth Cave and Roppo Cave had occurred a few months before the connection. And to hear him tell the story to the best of my memory, he was there with Don and Sherry, and then Roger Brucker and I think Lynn Brucker and one or two other people, and they kind of pushed into the breakdown where the Hawkins-Logsdon River emerges. They pushed around and didn't find anything. Well, Chris was sitting there changing his carbide lamp, and when he was done changing, everybody was in the breakdown and crawled off. So Chris went a different way and crawled through and popped through the breakdown and saw this river coming down. And so he wanted to see whether how far he'd gotten on the connection. And so I said, sure, I was game for that. So we ended up going into that area. Now, the connection trip and everything was done with full wetsuits and that. And Chris and I weren't wearing any wetsuits. We were just in polypropylene. And we ended up basically crawling through the area. Yes, that was where the connection was. So, you know, looks to me like Chris actually solo connected, you know, Roppo and Mammoth Cave by himself. He didn't map it, but he basically stared into the river coming downstream, and that's the Logsdon River. So we waded upstream many miles in that passage, waded, swum in areas, got to the sump in the Roppo. It was, thank God, it was open. A couple inches of airspace, got completely soaked, popped out the other side. And then we came out the Kangaroo Trail and came out the Roppo entrance. And, of course, at that time, we're about 5 or 6 miles away from our car, and we're way overdue. So we get out of the cave, and you know, I basically laid my shin open on a big rock wading in the river, bleeding, and I ended up using the first aid kit in the cave. And we start to walk back, and up comes a car on the road, and it turns out it was the gentleman who was living in the farmhouse nearby that I knew. And I said, hey, you know, could we catch a ride back with you? He goes, oh, sure, get in. Well, you know, we're completely slimed out, you know. And I said, well, why don't you get your truck? And he goes, okay, I'll drop the kids and the wife off and get the truck. And so he goes and gets his truck, and we get in the truck, and we start driving down the road, and we get down about a mile or two, and the truck runs out of gas.
Oh.
So it's like, God. Oh, great. Yeah. So he calls his wife. He knocks on this door. A guy comes to the door with a gun, and, you know, what do you want? Oh, well, I ran out of gas. Can I call my wife? Okay. He calls his wife. His wife gets the car, gets the kids, comes over, gets us, drives us back to our car. And then we finally get back to Jim's house real late. And Jim's completely freaked out that we're way overdue. So he's just really concerned. He says, yeah, I've already alerted a number of people. They're kind of on standby. And I said, yeah, and I understand this. So I told him, I said, Jim, we got really lost. We got incredibly lost. We wandered around for hours and hours and hours. And we finally came to an entrance. We figured we just better get out while we're getting out. It was good. And he goes, oh, my God, what entrance did you come out of? And I said, well, it was the Roppel entrance. And he goes, well, you made the connection, didn't you? I said, well, yeah, I guess that would count. And he said, well, I'm going to dock your pay, because we were making $4.25 an hour. And so, okay, I think it took an extra 2 hours. He goes, okay, your pay is docked 2 hours. It's like, okay, we were good with that. Jim, Chris, and I made the connection, and we're pretty to hell and gone and out there by ourselves. And I hate to say it, probably not using good practice, because if we'd have run into problems, it would have been pretty hard to backtrack maybe, and with the clothes and the carbide and things we had. So when you're young and dumb, you know, and think you can't be killed by anything short of kryptonite, sometimes you take some risks, you know. But well, it was an incredible trip.
You weren't so dumb, though, that you didn't know that that you were headed in the right direction at the very least.
Well, you know, Chris didn't know Roppel. I did. And so I knew the way out of the Roppel once we got through the S-163 sump. But I wasn't sure the sump was going to be open, because it was pretty late in the year and it rained some. And of course, we come walking out of the cave and it's misty and probably about 36 degrees. And we're in, you know, not even coveralls, jean jackets with some polypropylene underneath it, you know. And we probably would have died of hypothermia just walking back to the car. But, you know, we were tough. We were young, you know. As they say, strong like bull, smart like tractor.
So, oh, gosh.
It was a good trip. I will tell you one other that was associated with the Doyle Valley entrance. So we were drilling two monitoring wells into the lower Hawkins Logsdon River. And they were about 450 feet deep, and they were up in the park in the ridge. And the way to get to them was – easiest way to get through them was to go through the Doyle Valley entrance. And we ended up figuring out how to rappel down through this 17.5-inch diameter borehole. Then we actually rigged the haul system up the first time. And what happened was, when they were drilling the wells, they broke one of the drill bits off. It jammed into the hole, because they drilled into the top of the cave, and it was fairly late in the evening, and they left it there. And when they came back, there had been some rock or something slide down into the borehole, and it locked their drill bit up. So Jim was about ready to undergo his first quadruple bypass, and he called me up and said, hey, you need to put together a team, find some folks, put together a team, and see if you can go in there and unlodge it. So it's like, okay. So I call around, and I finally get a hold of George Vinnie, who just started graduate school there the year before. And Jim had some material that rapidly expanded when an electric cap was applied to it.
10-4.
Yeah, and so we went into the borehole, and it was very cold. It was probably 10 degrees out, 5 degrees out that day. And George and I carried wetsuits and enough material to build a wooden ladder and nails and a field phone and a whole bunch of other stuff, pieces of copper tubing and that. We went in there, and we drilled a hole through one of the other monitoring wells that were there and ran a line down, and we were talking to Jim, and we ended up putting this material up around the drill bit. And George and I moved down the passage some with the wire, and when we got up there, we were going to try and break the drill bit loose. And when we detonated the material, actually before we did that, George insisted that we move back and a little bit higher. There was some breakdown down the passage, and we got up into that. And when it went off, it knocked both of us flat to the ground, and we laid there for about 10 minutes laughing, silly, going, wow, I'm really glad you said move up a little higher. And Because it was basically 10 pounds of this material that was basically like an airburst in the cave passage. And that it was kind of, and we had a problems hearing for a little while. When we came out of the cave, they had left the lid off of the Doyle Valley entrance, and the cave was sucking so much cold air that when we entered the cave, well, as we got back into the room where the Doyle Valley entrance was, the fog in the room was so great that you could not see your feet. And we had to get on our hands and knees and crawl through this room, finding the left wall, and finally found our way up through basically what was whiteout conditions until we got real close to the entrance, in which case the cold air had basically froze all of the moisture-laden air, and we were able to get out. And then we got pulled out of the entrance, Doyle Valley entrance, by two cavers who were waiting up top. Later, Jim wanted to go in and see the monitoring wells and that, and he had just had his quadruple bypass about 2 months before, and he insisted that Joe Ray, who was his field technician, go in with him and with us and that, and he wanted me to lead him in there, and I said, well, okay, but Jim, if you vapor lock, you know, I'm not doing CPR on you, you know, it's just, it's not worth it, you know, you're gonna, that's it. And he didn't think that was very funny, but I thought it was. And Joe Ray hates caves, and Joe Ray was a great field technician and did a lot of work, you know, did a lot of the work measuring wells and dye tracing with Jim, but he really didn't like going in caves. And so Joe was trying to figure a way to get out of it. And he said, well, you know, Gary says this, you know, I've got to wear a wetsuit and I don't have one, so I can't go in the cave. And Jim said, well, I've got a wetsuit that'll fit you. Well, Jim didn't know whether he had one or not, a wetsuit that would fit Joe, but he had this wetsuit that somebody had left from a CRF expedition like 10 years before, and it was rolled up in a bag in his garage. And so Joe put it on, and we got lowered down, and it was a two-piece, you know, bottom and a top and that. And by the time we got into the cave very far, it had split from Joe's navel through his crotch up to the back of him. And he was walking around like a minotaur with certain things kind of hanging out. Of course, I couldn't resist hassling him about it. Careful, Joe, you know, I almost stepped on that, and, you know, you're leaving snail trails or whatever. And Joe was not happy. And him and Jim got in a pretty big argument in the cave. And I was thinking that Joe was going to beat up on Jim. Not that Jim didn't deserve it, but it was not going to be good, you know. So I had to interject myself into that. And I said, Jim. Now, you have to understand Jim, for those of you who have known him, he was an incredible friend and mentor, my employer and later my employee. And I knew Jim for many, many years and that had a wonderful relationship with him. But Jim could sometimes be a little overbearing. So I said, thinking quick on my feet, I said, hey, Jim, did you send in your application for the International Who's Who of Speleology? And he said, what? What? No. What? I said, well, I sent mine in, and it was like $25, and you had to send it to these guys in Paris. And he said, oh, Paris, who was it? And he names off a bunch of French, you know, speleologists that he knew. And I'm, of course, no, it was somebody named Jacques, somebody. I don't know. I don't remember. But he had some $25, but the deadline's passed. And he says, what? And I said, yeah, you know, you had to write a, you know, resume of all the good stuff you've done and that, and fill it out and things and that. And I said, well, you know, maybe they haven't heard of you or something, you know. And, well, I can't believe that. I know a lot of those people. And of course, I, you know, just jerking the chain. And Joe was catching on and watching me play Jim like a big fish. And I finally said, yeah, you know, you fill it out, but for $50, they'll consider you even more. And Jim said, well, that's scandalous. And, couldn't believe that he hadn't been asked to, because I was just a lowly graduate student, hadn't written a paper, and Jim, you know, had a PhD and, you know, traveled all over the world, you know, doing karst work and attending conferences and that, and he was going to be greatly disappointed he wasn't going to be in the International Who's Who of Speleology. So that was Jim.
Oh, so, goodness. Anyway,
three good caving stories for you.
Oh, marvelous. Thank you for those. I guess let's get into the leadership of the NSS and really just caving leadership in general. So at 19, you were the chair of the grotto in D.C. that you were
It was the Sligo Grotto, which is Sligo's in Maryland, 19 or 20. And when I was a undergraduate, I was going to a community college for my first 2 years, Montgomery College. And the Sligo Grotto was very friendly and met a lot of good people there and somehow got myself elected as chair. And it was a very interesting experience.
Yeah, did you just kind of get swept up into it, or were you looking for a leadership position?
No, I wasn't really looking for a leadership position. I never really do. But at the time, I was doing a lot of caving and putting together a lot of trips and doing a lot of training. I was working in an outdoor store there called Hudson Bay Outfitters, later became Hudson Trail Outfitters. And had been doing basically every vertical cave and horizontal cave I could get my fingers on. And so was busy caving a couple times a month, if not more. And then in interspace in that was also rock climbing. So traditional climbing at Seneca Rocks and top roping and solo bouldering and things in at Carter Rock in Maryland. So
it was just kind of a situation where they just were like, hey, how about you lead this thing? And you're like, yeah, sure. Why not? And then you get into it and you're like, okay, what have I signed up for?
Exactly. It's just what I call the greater fool theory. Somewhere out there is a bigger fool. And I happened to be it at the time. I think part of it was I wanted to go caving and I was going to make it happen. Spent a lot of time. I taught myself how to plot latitude and longitude when I was 16 or 17 and started figuring out where caves were located and getting out there and visiting some of these things. At the time, the caving community was in some areas was pretty cliquish. Matter of fact, I was attending DC Grotto meetings and that for many years and that, but actually never joined because I couldn't join because I didn't have somebody who would sponsor me. And the only way you could get sponsored was to go on a trip with somebody. And the only trips they were leading at the time were the Oregon Cave. And you couldn't go to Oregon Cave unless you were a member. So it's this kind of catch 22 problem.
Yeah.
And I probably could have pushed it a little bit more and found some other ways in. But to be honest with you, I was doing plenty of caving with the Sligo Grotto and then went to school at West Virginia University and, was even closer to the caves and was caving almost every weekend.
So then as the chair of that grotto, what did you end up having to do? I mean, did you have business meetings? I mean, did you put on events and things like that?
We did. Matter of fact, we worked with folks. I think there was a cave there, Silers, that we were working with the owner and was able to gate and control access in that. The cave had been closed for many, many years. And so as the Sligo Grotto members, I understand there was another cave nearby that was discovered by Sligo Grotto members that they actually ended up buying in that. But yeah, there was a Sligo Grotto was pretty active and we did trips to Alabama. Some of my early caving mentors were Bob Campbell, who was from Alabama and moved up to the DC area. He was in the military. And then his best caving buddy was he'd met in Alabama was Alex Sproul. And so I got to know Alex and we did some really great caving in the Snedeker system, Crookshank. I took him into Cass and they took me into Snedeker's and Crookshank and some other caves and that. And that's been a lifelong relationship. I've known Alex since I was probably 21 or so.
So I guess here's where it gets a little autobiographical on my part. So I've been involved with my grotto for only really about 7 or 8 years and now I'm the chairman and I'm enjoying it. I'm doing the work and I'm doing the stuff. I'm going to serve my 2 years and then I'm going to step away. You have, of course, made it to the top, essentially. What was it that made you decide, I'm going to just stick with this and do it? Obviously, you have a professional connection, but what else?
Well, I've served in some leadership roles at the grotto level. I was also chair of the West Virginia University Student Grotto. And also the Green River Grotto when I was a graduate student. And the thought is that I think if you want to make something happen, sometimes taking a leadership role is important. And then with the Nashville Grotto, I think I was program chair or something, but I actually was never grotto chair. I, at that point, decided I would stand back a little bit and try and, I don't know if you do words, we use the word mentor, but kind of behind the scenes, you know, helping new cavers, doing caving and doing training, vertical training. And then got involved with the SCCI also, and was on their board for a couple of years until I moved down to Texas. So in that role, basically, even moving down to San Antonio, I've only had, you know, leadership roles as like vice chair of programs and that, preferring to allow some other folks to step up and take those leadership roles. It wasn't until William Shrewsbury contacted me that and asked me to serve as the administrative vice president, because he knew I'd had a lot of experience working with SCCI and Texas Cave Management Association, and then also you know, working as a professional geologist in Tennessee and Kentucky and Texas and that. So for some reason, I agreed. I served, I think, five and a half years. A very enjoyable experience. You know, strongly encourage anybody, you know, who has the opportunity to take a leadership role in a committee or a division, or you know, even as one of the officers of the NSS. I found it very rewarding. I stepped down for a couple years. And then was asked by the board if I would consider running for president, which I told them I would. And that basically elected last year and took over in New Mexico.
What then is your expected term? How long are you going to be remaining at the position?
Well, I was hoping that I'd get fired in November at the board meeting, or October in the board meeting, but that, I don't think that's going to happen. So
you're not trying to get fired. You're just hoping maybe somebody else wanted it.
Yeah, exactly. You, to really understand the position, you really need to serve a couple years at least. William came off the position serving, I think, 7 years as president and a number of years as operations vice president also. So he's paid his dues, and he was, you know, he basically done everything. You know, he initiated the purchase of the headquarters and brought a lot of new ideas and that. But I think he, you know, has acquired this business on Rope One and wanted to devote more time to that, and thought there should be some new ideas, new energy that be brought to the position. So I guess I'm it.
Well, yeah. I mean, among those new ideas and new decisions and whatnot, I mean, what do you hope to continue to bring to the table? I mean, obviously, you've been at it for, a year now, almost a year. And
yep.
What are some of the current problems or issues, challenges that you see that you're hoping to take on in your remaining tenure?
We've identified a couple issues. We've got we've made a lot of progress in some areas, and we've got some challenges. You know, the biggest concern we have is membership. Now, most social and fraternal organizations across the U.S. are shedding members as many of their members age, and younger folks aren't necessarily joining these kinds of organizations in the same numbers they have in the past. We're seeing our membership decline. It's gone from a high of over 11,000 to about 8,680 or 90 right now. So we've lost about 2,000 members over the last 7 years. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is, you know, question about people joining. White nose syndrome has, you know, really hampered our ability to get into some caves, you know, has created issues with being able to recruit and retain people. I think that we need to adopt some of our social media programs, which we're doing pretty well, but, you know, certainly can do better, to try and attract some of the younger members. You know, access to caves is becoming a little bit more difficult. Also, just landowner relations wise, there are caves that are getting tied up by landowners and that, and liability issues and that. So there's a lot of different pressures in that. from the data I've seen, we haven't lost members as quickly as some other organizations, some of the large outdoor organizations that are there, but also some of the social fraternal organizations that you see. For example, the Shriners, who we were able to purchase our headquarters from, their membership has been aging and declining, and they're just not getting new, younger folks in to keep the organizations going. And so we were able to purchase the headquarters at a phenomenal deal at a good time with good interest rates and at a very good price.
Well, it sounds to me like it's not just an NSS problem. It's a problem nationwide with just fraternal and charitable and nonprofit organizations. Just people, I guess interest among the younger generations is just not there as much.
Well, and there's more demand in the sense that if you think about the outdoor activities that were available when I was in college, and that's where many of our members join. The outdoor pursuits were, you know, you could hike, you could backpack, you could canoe, you could rock climb. That was out there on the fringe. And then there's this underground activity, you know, caving. And, you know, at the time we had a pretty low profile, you know, God forbid we attract more people to the sport. and that was the attitude.
Yeah, let's talk about that. It seems like cavers have always, at least a certain and somewhat vocal and I guess influential number of cavers have said, let's keep this secret. Let's keep this to us. Let's do that. I mean, how do you feel about that?
Well, you know, that's interesting because in the 70s when I first started caving, that was certainly the attitude was, and I understood that, you know, it was the most amazing thing I'd ever seen, caving was, and amazing places, amazing people, and I couldn't believe that, you know, everyone on the planet didn't want to go into a cave. You know, how could they not? It certainly was my passion in life. And then I was working in an outdoor store, and here are people who go outdoors and would probably be your prime recruiting, you know, population. And when I was talking to people in the outdoor store, very few of them were actually very interested in caving. So even among the rock climbing, backpacking, hiking, cross-country skiing populations, when they would come in and when I would strike up a conversation, they'd ask about, you know, what I've been doing and that, and I talked to them about caving. They didn't understand it and were not interested. So I think contrary to popular belief, not everyone wants to crawl into a cave. I don't understand it. I think I don't understand why you wouldn't, but that's the attitude, you know. And I still see that. And if you think about it, I mean, I work with 100 people, and we are composed of geologists and hydrologists and many others. And there's only two or three of us that are really that interested in looking at caves and karst features. Even though they're trying to tell us some important information about how water moves through these karst aquifers. So part of it is, though, is I think that you do not protect and you do not protect what you don't know about or understand. And so part of our issue is that we have had a very low-key approach. In addition, and for young people right now, there is a lot of activities that are basically trying to attract their attention. Mountain biking wasn't even heard of when I was in college. It's now a major sport. There are lots of other activities that people are involved in that take up their time. You know, everything from, you know, parachuting, hang gliding, rock climbing has become much more popular. You know, canoeing, hiking, etc. So the data I've seen indicates that as a population, about the same percentage of the population over the last 30 years are still going outdoors. The actual number of people going out is increasing because the population has increased. So there should be an active group that we could recruit from. And I think that we don't necessarily need to recruit more members for members' sake, even though more members helps us on a lot of fronts, but we can certainly do a better job in getting our message out to protect bats, to protect caves, to protect karst features, protect sinkholes, protect groundwater, et cetera. You know, I think we are the authority on you know, caves and karst and cave conservation and education and that. We certainly need to do a better job outreach in making people aware of these resources. So
yeah, so it sounds to me like it's a numbers game. Like we just need to get the numbers to match up. We need to figure out a way to promote and get the, you know, this sort of national interest in outdoor activities. We need to make sure everyone who are doing those things are aware that there are people who like to go explore caves?
Well, you have to dedicate the time for new people. And I think you've got, you know, we have found with the Bear Grotto here in San Antonio, our grotto is growing. And we've actually had to move into a larger room. And what we found is that we are getting a lot of young people through a number of different avenues. One of those is Meetup, which is a webpage for that basically just lists activities in your city. And we have a Meetup page, and we're getting a couple new visitors every month or every meeting. And then we're lucky that we live very close. You know, there are a number of caves right here in the San Antonio area, so we can get these people underground and get them assimilated into the caving culture and, you know, the you know, what we're trying to do conservation-wise and message-wise. And so we've gotten a bunch of really great new members that way. So doing that outreach, making people feel welcome, trying to get them underground, educate them a little bit. We have equipment that they can borrow, so they don't have to make a big investment before they try it out and see if they like it. And I think that's gone a long ways in really, you know, growing our membership.
We've kind of done the same thing with the Central Indiana Grotto. I mean, we in just the last 5 years, we've gotten an REI in Indianapolis, the only one in the area. They do monthly events and things like that. And so we've gotten on the list through one of our very active members and the guy who got me into caving, Paul Uglum. And, you know, just setting that up, I mean, it seems like places like that who put on classes and things like that are always looking for new material. So it seems like if you're a local grotto and you're struggling with membership, you need to just find those outlets and put on those classes, and then they work to do the email blast and get the promotion out there. And then you can use that as a recruitment tool. And in fact, we've got a trip going out this weekend to a very popular and well-known Indiana cave full of all the people who went to that class who were interested in caving, and they're going to go try it this weekend.
You bet. You'll end up with some new members out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the whole idea.
Yeah, that's exactly, that's partial our model too. We've done the same thing with classes through REI and through some of the other outdoor stores. We have a couple, universities here in town, and we, reach out to their outdoor club, and we take those folks caving, the geology club and the outdoor club and the outdoor rec center and that. And so we have, programs there, and we'll attract a couple members. So, you know, again, may only get a few members out of it, but what you are doing is you got that contact with people who will remember that caving event and realize that cave and car, you know, resources are fragile and will now understand why we want to protect them, even if they never go caving again.
What would you say to the person listening who wants to do their part to support the NSS and caving in general?
Well, you know, there's a couple ways to do that. Of course, you know, my recommendation would be join the grotto, become active, take a leadership role, look at what you can do to, you know, for education, for conservation purposes, and also recruitment of new people. And then, you know, the other way, if you don't have the time, is but if you're lucky enough to have the financial resources, is to help sponsor or support, you know, the national organization, the NSS, or your local grotto. And we've had some folks who have been very generous and made some very sizable donations to the NSS. And with that, we've been able to purchase caves. We have a large donation that was made at the NSS convention of over $400,000 that's targeted for our museum and education programs. And one of the things I've done when I came into president is I thought there were three areas that we needed to work on. The first one was membership. And Christine Embry, who is a board member, headed up an ad hoc membership committee and has a number of really good recommendations, which we're starting to implement now. The second area that I thought we needed to do some work on was the conventions. And Julie Shank Brown, also a board member, has been heading that up. And that ad hoc committee also has a report with a number of recommendations to how can we improve our conventions, how can we allocate resources and keep financially keeping the costs low, yet providing a valuable experience, et cetera. How do we, you know, improve continuity between conventions, et cetera. And the third, the ad hoc committee that we formed was for the museum and education. And Pat Sizer from New Mexico headed that up, and she also has a report. And I think we're making a lot of progress. Our headquarters down in Huntsville, Alabama, is not only is it our, you know, where we have our offices and our membership and our, you know, our records and our library and that, but we're looking at what we need to do for a museum there. And also we have five very nice rooms in the back that can be used for educational purposes. And my intent is to try and see if we can expand our program to create day-long to week-long education programs, you know, out of the Huntsville office. I'd love to see us teaching, you know, cave photography, karst hydrology, cave rescue, vertical caving, horizontal caving, cave biology, cave archaeology, and that attracts new members, and it also provides a really nice resource for members. But we have the world experts in many of these areas in our membership, and we should be tapping those folks and having them present courses for the membership and for the public. I'm excited about it. There are some other things I want to see us do. You know, the Texas Cave Management Association owns Robert Barron Cave here in San Antonio, and it's this well-known cave in the, you know, in the public, you know, folklore and that. And they open it up about every 18 months to an open house. And they did that last weekend and had over 550 people go through it. It's a major fundraiser for them. A great outreach opportunity. There were lots of booths, you know, from educational, you know, organizations, Master Naturalist, the TCMA had their booth there, Bear Grotto, the NSS had a booth there. We actually recruited a couple members. The Edwards Aquifer had a booth there. Bat Rehab, Bat Conservation International had a booth. And you had all this contact with all these people, and we did a lot of education and outreach. And it was also a big fundraiser in that. And I'd like to think that maybe there are some of our preserves that we may be able to do that with. In particular, Shelta may be a good example of that. You know, it's right downtown. People know about the cave. It used to be a former commercial cave. Can we use it for education and conservation? Tell people why they shouldn't be spray painting in caves. Talk about the unique animals, the fact that bats are, you know, are being threatened, and talk a little bit about the geology and the importance of caves and karst and groundwater quality and that. So those kinds of outreach things I think are really important. And like I say, most of the community is curious, but they don't necessarily want to go and become a hardcore caver, but they'll certainly go give it a try if given the opportunity.
Well, so much competition on people's time. I mean,
there is. There really is.
Netflix. I mean, it's so easy to just stay home and just watch TV, and but it's so hard to get anybody outside for any reason. But if you really give them something interesting and compelling about the place where they live these days, I think people not only are they stuck inside, but they're also hungry to look inward and look at the place where they live and learn. So it's not all doom and gloom where that's concerned.
You bet. I think there's a lot of opportunities here. We just need to be more proactive and utilize some of the social media to get it. And this podcast is a great example of that.
Well, I appreciate that. And thank you for coming up with with the sort of direction moving forward. I mean, I guess one thing that I'm curious about, you being based in San Antonio, how often do you make it to Huntsville?
I try and get up there a couple times a year. Have been having our executive committee meetings there. We will have a board meeting there every couple years also.
I guess to close, what do you hope for the future of the NSS? Basically, I guess, what do you see coming and what do you hope might be coming as maybe a byproduct of the future?
Well, you know, we need to turn our membership, you know, issues around and either stabilize that or start growing the membership. We're losing about 300 members a year. And I think we need to turn that around. You know, the membership fees pay for a lot of our overhead administrative costs, you know, the bookstore, the, you know, our office manager and their bookkeeper and all the other things that we do, NSS News, Cave Accidents Report, et cetera. So we need to basically recruit some additional members and start retaining some of the members we have, trying to bring back some of the members that used to be active with us that have, for whatever reason, moved on. Maybe we can bring some of those back and also recruit new members. That's our primary, you know, challenge and my biggest goal. I'd like to see us pay off the headquarters. We've got a 7-year note on that. We're about 90% done, but we need to generate some revenue to pay that off. It's basically were able to meet the monthly mortgage pretty much through the Team 404, but we could use more members there. And then, you know, the other thing I'd love to see us do is expand our education and conservation programs. We should set, you know, the national example for those programs. And I think we can initiate those in Huntsville and then move them out into some of the other regions where we could do training and education programs throughout our caving community across the country.
Get involved, promote caving, and educate the public, even if they don't want to go caving. I mean, that sounds like the triptych there.
You bet. And the education of the public is important because, like I say, you won't protect it if you don't know about it or understand it.
That's right. Gary Schindel, thank you so much for coming on the Caving Podcast. And here's to another great year, and here's to the rest of your tenure as NSS president.
Great. Thank you very much. Appreciate being invited, Matt.
Wow. I'm pretty happy he's the guy at the helm. And yeah, if you're able and willing to take on a leadership position within your grotto, do it. Or you can just volunteer your time with the grotto. And, you know, if there are things you can help out with, do that. If I can do it, anybody can. Thanks for your time, Gary. And since he and I did that over Skype, that opens up the possibility for having more national guests. If I've reached out to you and with the implication that you would have to come to Indianapolis, you no longer have to do that. If we could Skype or FaceTime or something like that, that would be perfectly acceptable, as you just heard. Remember to support the podcast by supporting our sponsors, Organic Robot on Etsy, Swago. Those test packs are still going through caves. Hopefully we'll hear something on new Swago packs soon. Visit swagogear.com or hit them up on Facebook. Also, you can support the podcast directly on Patreon at patreon.com/cavingpodcast. $1 from everyone listening would be so, so great. All proceeds go right back into caving. Is that everything? I think so. Nobody's booked for next month yet, but I'm going to do my best to make it a great guest. Suggestions? Email alpineproductions@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. I'm Matt Pelser, chairman of the Central Indiana Grotto. Until next time, kill nothing but time.